"Is anyone here?" Henry asks. There is a tremble in his voice that he hates, an old man's palsied quaver. "Is anyone in the house with me?" For a terrible second, he is almost afraid something will answer. Nothing does. Of course nothing does. And he swallows half the can of beer in three long gulps. He decides he'll go back into the living room and read for a little while. Maybe Jack will call. Maybe he'll get himself a little more under control once he has a little fresh alcohol in his system. And maybe the world will end in the next 5 minutes, he thinks. That way you'll never have to deal with a voice on those damned tapes waiting in the studio. Those damned tapes lying there on the soundboard like unexploded bombs. Henry walks slowly back down the hall to the living room, with one hand held out before him, telling himself he's not afraid, not a bit afraid of touching his wife's dead face. Jack Sawyer has seen a lot. He's traveled to places where you can't rent from Avis and the water tastes like wine. But he's never encountered anything like Mouse Bauman's leg. Or, rather, the pestilential apocalyptic horror show that was Mouse Bauman's leg. Jack's first impulse, once he's got himself back under something like control, is to upbraid Doc for taking off Mouse's pants. Jack keeps thinking of sausages and how the casing forces them to keep their shape even after the fry pan's sizzling on a red-hot burner. This is an undoubtedly stupid comparison, primo stupido, but the human mind under pressure puts on some pretty odd jinks and jumps. There's still the shape of a leg there, sort of, but the flesh has spread away from the bone. The skin is almost completely gone, melted to a runny substance that looks like a mixture of milk and bacon fat. The interwoven mat of muscle beneath what remains of the skin is sagging and undergoing the same cataclysmic metamorphosis. The infected leg is in a kind of undisciplined motion as the solid becomes liquid and the liquid sizzles relentlessly into the couch upon which Mouse is lying. Along with the almost insupportable stench of decay, Jack can smell scorching cloth and melting fabric. Poking out of this spreading, vaguely leg-like mess is a foot that looks remarkably undamaged. If I wanted to, I could pull it right off, just like a squash off a vine. The thought gets to him in a way the sight of the grievously wounded leg hasn't quite been able to. And for a moment, Jack can only bow his head, gagging and trying not to vomit down the front of his shirt. What perhaps saves him is a hand on his back. It's Beezer, offering what comfort he can. The rowdy color has completely left the Beezer's face. He looks like a motorcyclist come back from the grave in an urban myth. "You see," Doc is asking, and his voice seems to come from a great distance. "This ain't the chicken pox, my friend, although it looked a little like that while it was still getting cranked up. He's already exhibiting red spots on his left leg, his belly, his balls. That's pretty much what the skin around the bite looked like when we first got him back here, just some redness and swelling. I thought, shit, ain't nothing to this. I got enough Zithromax to put this on the run before sundown. Well, you see what good the Zithro did. You see what good anything did. It's eating through the couch. And I'm guessing that when it finishes with the couch, it'll go right to work on the floor. This shit is hungry. So was it worth it, Hollywood? I guess only you and Mouse know the answer to that." "He still knows where the house is," Beezer says. "Me, I don't have a clue, even though we just came from there. You either, do you?" Doc shakes his head. "But Mouse, he knows." "Susie, honey," Doc says to Bear Girl, "bring another blanket, would you? This one's damn near it through." Bear Girl goes willingly enough. Jack gets to his feet. His legs are rubbery, but they hold him. "Shield him," he tells Doc. "I'm going out to the kitchen. If I don't get a drink, I'm going to die." Jack takes on water directly from the sink, swallowing until a spike plants itself in the center of his forehead, and he belches like a horse. Then he just stands there, looking out into Beezer and Bear Girl's backyard. A neat little swing set has been planted there in the weedy desolation. It hurts Jack to look at it, but he looks anyway. After the lunacy of Mouse's leg, it seems important to remind himself that he's here for a reason. If the reminder hurts, so much the better. The sun, now turning gold as it eases itself down toward the Mississippi, glares in his eyes. Time hasn't been standing still after all, it seems. Not outside this little house, anyway. Outside one nail house row, time actually seems to have sped up. He's haunted by the idea that coming here was as pointless as detouring to Henry's house, tormented by the thought that Mr. Munshun and his boss, the Abala, are running him around like a wind-up toy with a key in its back while they do their work. He can follow that buzz in his head to Black House, so why the hell doesn't he just get back in his truck and do it? The perfume he smells is not that of his dead wife. What does that mean? Why does the idea of someone smelling perfume make him so crazy and afraid? Beezer knocks on the kitchen door, making him jump. Jack's eye fixes on a sampler hung over the kitchen table. Instead of God Bless Our Home, it reads Heavy Metal Thunder, with a carefully stitched Harley Davidson beneath. Get back in here, man, the bee says. He's awake again. Henry's on a path in the woods. Or maybe it's a lane. And something is behind him. Each time he turns to see, in this dream he can see, but seeing is no blessing, there's a little more of that something back there. It appears to be a man in evening dress, but the man is frightfully elongated, with spike teeth that jut over a smiling red lower lip. And he seems, is it possible, to have only one eye. The first time Henry looks back, the shape is only a milky blur amid the trees. The next time he can make out the uneasy dark swim of its coat and a floating red blotch that might be a tie or an ascot. Up ahead of him is this thing's den, a stinking hole that only coincidentally looks like a house. Its presence buzzes in Henry's head. Instead of pine, the woods pressing in on either side smell of heavy, cloying perfume. My sin. It's driving me, he thinks with dismay. Whatever that thing back there is, it's driving me like a steer toward the slaughterhouse. He thinks of cutting off the lane to his left or right, of using the miracle of his new sight to escape through the woods. Only there are things there, too, dark floating shapes like sooty scarves. He can almost see the closest. It's some sort of gigantic dog with a long tongue as red as the apparition's tie and bulging eyes. Can't let it drive me to the house, he thinks. I have to get out of this before it can get me there. But how? How? It comes to him with startling simplicity. All he has to do is wake up, because this is a dream. This is just a... It's a dream! Henry cries out and jerks forward. He's not walking. He's sitting. Sitting in his very own easy chair. And pretty soon he's going to have a very wet crotch, because he fell asleep with a can of Kingsland lager balanced there, and... But there's no spill, because there's no can of beer. He feels cautiously to his right. And yep, there it is, on the table with his book, a Braille edition of Reflections in a Golden Eye. He must have put it there before first falling asleep and then falling into that horrible nightmare. Except, Henry's pretty sure he didn't do any such thing. He was holding the book, and the beer was between his legs, freeing his hands to touch the little upraised dots that tell the story. Something very considerately took both the book and the can after he dropped off and put them on the table. Something that smells of my sin perfume. The air reeks of it. Henry takes a long, slow breath with his nostrils flared and mouth tightly sealed shut. No, he says, speaking very clearly, I can smell flowers and rug shampoo and fried onions from last night, very faint but still there. The nose knows. All true enough. But the smell had been there. It's gone now because she's gone. But she will be back. And suddenly he wants her to come. If he's frightened, surely it's the unknown he's frightened of, right? Only that, and nothing more. He doesn't want to be alone here, with nothing for company but the memory of that rancid dream. And the tapes. He has to listen to the tapes. He promised Jack. Henry gets shakily to his feet and makes his way to the living room control panel. This time he's greeted by the voice of Symphonic Stan, a mellow fellow if ever there was one. "Hey there, all you hoppin' cats and boppin' kitties at the tone at 7:14 p.m. Bulova watch time. Outside, the temp is a very cool 75 degrees, and here in the make-believe ballroom, it's a very nifty 70 degrees. So why not get off your money, grab your honey, and make a little magic?" 7:14? When was the last time he fell asleep for almost 3 hours in the daytime? For that matter, when was the last time he had a dream in which he could see? The answer to that second question, so far as he can remember, is never. Where was that lane? What was the thing behind him? What was the place ahead of him, for that matter? "Doesn't matter," Henry tells the empty room. "If it is empty, it was a dream, that's all. The tapes, on the other hand, he doesn't want to listen to them. Has never wanted to listen to anything any less in his life. With the possible exception of Chicago singing Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? But he has to. If it might save Time Marshall's life, or the life of even one other child, he must. Slowly, dreading every step, Henry Layden makes his blind way to his studio, where two cassettes wait for him on the soundboard. "In heaven there is no beer," Mouse sings, in a toneless, droning voice. His cheeks are now covered with ugly red patches, and his nose seems to be sinking sideways into his face, like an atoll after an undersea earthquake. "That's why we drink it here, and when we're gone from here, our friends will be drinking all the beer." It's been like this for hours now. Philosophical nuggets, instructions for the beginning beer-making enthusiast, snatches of song. The light coming through the blankets over the windows has dimmed appreciably. Mouse pauses, his eyes closed. Then he starts another ditty. 100 bottles of beer on the wall, 100 bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, I have to go," Jack says. He's hung in there as well as he can, convinced that Mouse is going to give him something, but he can wait no longer. Somewhere, Time Marshall is waiting for him. "Hold on," Doc says. He rummages in his bag and comes out with a hypodermic needle. He raises it in the dimness and taps the glass barrel with a fingernail. "What's that?" Doc gives Jack and Beezer a brief, grim smile. "Speed," he says, and injects it into Mouse's arm. For a moment, there's nothing. Then, as Jack is opening his mouth again to tell them he has to go, Mouse's eyes snap wide. They are now entirely red, a bright and bleeding red. Yet when they turn in his direction, Jack knows that Mouse is seeing him, maybe really seeing him for the first time since he got here. Bear Girl flees the room, trailing a single diminishing phrase behind her. "No more, no more, no more, no more." "Fuck," Mouse says in a rusty voice. "Fuck, I'm fucked, ain't I?" Beezer touches the top of his friend's head briefly but tenderly. "Yeah, man, I think you are. Can you help us out?" "Bit me once, just once, and now, his hideous red gaze turns to Doc. "Can barely see you. Fucking eyes are all weird." "You're going down," Doc says. "Ain't gonna lie to you, man." "Not yet I ain't," Mouse says. "Give me something to write on, to draw a map on. Quick, don't know what you shot me with, Doc, but the stuff from the dog's stronger. I ain't gonna be composed long. Quick!" Beezer feels around at the foot of the couch and comes up with a trade-sized paperback. Given the heavy shit on the bookcases, Jack could almost laugh. The book is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Beezer tears off the back cover and hands it to Mouse with the blank side up.
"Pencil," Mouse croaks. "Hurry up. I got it all, man. I got it up here."
He touches his forehead. A patch of skin the size of a quarter sloughs off at his touch. Mouse wipes it on the blanket as if it were a booger. Beezer pulls a gnawed stub of pencil from an inside pocket of his vest. Mouse takes it and makes a pathetic effort to smile. The black stuff oozing from the corners of his eyes has continued to build up, and now it lies on his cheeks like smears of decayed jelly. More of it is springing out of the pores on his forehead in minute black dots that remind Jack of Henry's Braille books. When Mouse bites his lower lip in concentration, the tender flesh splits open at once. Blood begins dribbling into his beard. Jack supposes the rotted meat smell is still there, but Beezer had been right. He's gotten used to it. Mouse turns the book cover sideways, then draws a series of quick squiggles.
"Look it," he says to Jack. "This is the Mississippi, right?"
"Right," Jack says. When he leans in, he starts getting the smell again. Up close, it's not even a stench. It's a miasma trying to crawl down his throat. But Jack doesn't move away. He knows what an effort Mouse is making. The least he can do is play his part.
"Here's downtown. The Nelson. Lucky's. The Agincourt Theater. The Tap Room. Here's where Chase Street turns into Lyle Road, then Route 35. Here's Libertyville. The VFW. Goltz's. Oh, Christ!"
Mouse begins to thrash on the couch. Sores on his face and upper body burst open and begin leaking. He screams with pain. The hand not holding the pencil goes to his face and paws at it ineffectually. Something inside Jack speaks up, then speaks in a shining, imperative voice he remembers from his time on the road all those years ago. He supposes it's the voice of the talisman, or whatever remains of it in his mind and soul. It doesn't want him to talk. It's trying to kill him before he can talk. It's in the black stuff. Maybe it is the black stuff. You've got to get rid of it. Some things can only be done without the mind's prudish interference. When the work is nasty, instinct is often best. So it is without thinking that Jack reaches out, grasps the black slime oozing from Mouse's eyes between his fingers, and pulls. At first, the stuff only stretches, as if made of rubber. At the same time, Jack can feel it squirming and writhing in his grip, perhaps trying to pinch or bite him. Then it lets go with an audible twang sound. Jack throws the convulsing black tissue onto the floor with a cry. The stuff tries to slither beneath the couch. Jack sees this even as he wipes his hands on his shirt, frantic with revulsion. Doc slams his bag down on one piece. Beezer squashes the other with the heel of a motorcycle boot. It makes a squittering sound.
"What the fuck is that shit?"
Doc asks. His voice, ordinarily husky, has gone up into a near falsetto range.
"What the fuck?"
"Nothing from here," Jack says. "And never mind. Look at him. Look at Mouse." The red glare in Mouse's eyes has retreated. For the moment, he looks almost normal. Certainly, he's seeing them, and the pain seems gone.
"Thanks," he breathes. "I only wish you could get it all that way, but man, it's already coming back. Pay attention."
"I'm listening," Jack says.
"You better," Mouse replies. "You think you know. You think you can find the place again, even if these two can't. And maybe you can, but maybe you don't know quite so much as you... Ah, fuck!"
From somewhere beneath the blanket, there is a ghastly bursting sound as something gives way. Sweat runs down Mouse's face, mixing with the black poison venting from his pores and turning his beard a damp and dirty gray. His eyes roll up to Jack's, and Jack can see that red glare starting to haze over them again.
"This sucks," Mouse pants. "Never thought I'd go out this way. Look at Hollywood."
The dying man draws a small rectangle on his makeshift scribble of map.
"This Ed's Eats, where we found Irma," Jack says. "I know." "All right," Mouse whispers. "Good. Now look, over on the other side, the Schubert and Gale side, and to the west."
Mouse draws a line going north from Highway 35. He puts little circles on either side of it. Jack takes these to be representations of trees. And across the front of the line, like a gate, no trespassing. "Yeah," Doc breathes. "That's where it was, all right. Black house." Mouse takes no notice. His dimming gaze is fixed solely on Jack.
"Listen to me, cop. Are you listening?"
"Yes."
"Christ, you better be," Mouse tells him.
As it always has, the work captures Henry, absorbs him, takes him away. Boredom and sorrow have never been able to stand against this old captivation with sound from the sighted world. Apparently, fear can't stand against it either. The hardest moment isn't listening to the tapes, but mustering the courage to stick the first one in the big TIAC audio deck. In that moment of hesitation, he's sure he can smell his wife's perfume, even in the soundproofed and air-filtered environment of the studio. In that moment of hesitation, he is positive he isn't alone, that someone or something is standing just outside the studio door, looking in at him through the glass upper half. And that is, in fact, the absolute truth. Blessed with sight as we are, we can see what Henry cannot. We want to tell him what's out there, to lock the studio door. For the love of God, lock it now. But we can only watch. Henry reaches for the play button on the tape deck. Then his finger changes course and hits the intercom toggle instead. Hello? Is anyone out there? The figure standing in Henry's living room, looking in at him the way someone might look into an aquarium at a single exotic fish, makes no sound. The last of the sun's on the other side of the house, and the living room is becoming quite dark, Henry being understandably forgetful when it comes to turning on the lights. Elmer Jesperson's amusing bee slippers, not that they amuse us much under these circumstances, are just about the brightest things out there. Hello? Anyone? The figure looking in through the glass half of the studio door is grinning. In one hand, it is holding the hedge clippers from Henry's garage. Last chance, Henry says. And when there's still no response, he becomes the Wisconsin rat, shrieking into the intercom, trying to startle whatever's out there into revealing itself. Come on now, honey! Come on now, you motherfucker! Talk to Ratty! The figure peering in at Henry recoils, as a snake might recoil when its prey makes a feint, but it utters no sound. From between the grinning teeth comes a leathery old tongue, wagging and poking in derision. This creature has been into the perfume that Mrs. Morton has never had the heart to remove from the vanity in the little powder room adjacent to the master bedroom, and now Henry's visitor reeks of my sin. Henry decides it's all just his imagination playing him up again, always such a mistake, Morris Rosen would have told him had Morris been there, and hits play with the tip of his finger. He hears a throat-clearing sound, and then Arnold Hrabowski identifies himself. The fisherman interrupts him before he can even finish. Hello, asswipe. Henry rewinds, listens again. Hello, asswipe. Rewinds and listens yet again. Hello, asswipe. Yes, he has heard this voice before. He's sure of it. But where? The answer will come. Answers of this sort always do. Eventually. And getting there is half the fun. Henry listens, enrapt. His fingers dance back and forth over the tape deck's buttons like the fingers of a concert pianist over the keys of a Steinway. The feeling of being watched slips from him, although the figure outside the studio door, the thing wearing the bee slippers and holding the hedge clippers, never moves. Its smile has faded somewhat. A sulky expression is growing on its aged face. There is confusion in that look, and perhaps the first faint trace of fear. The old monster doesn't like it that the blind fish in the aquarium should have captured its voice. Of course, it doesn't matter. Maybe it's even part of the fun. But if it is, it's Mr. Munshun's fun, not its fun. And their fun should be the same, shouldn't it? You have an emergency, not me, you. Not me, you, Henry says. The mimicry is so good, it's weird. A little bit of sauerkraut in your salad, my friend, yeah? Your worst nightmare, Abala. I'm the fisherman. Henry, listening, intent. He lets the tape run a while, then listens to the same phrase four times over.
Kiss my scrot, you monkey. Kiss my scrot, you monkey. You monkey. Monkey.
No, not monkey. The voice is actually saying mungy. Mungy.
I don't know where you are now, but you grew up in Chicago, Henry murmurs. South Side, and
warmth on his face. Suddenly he remembers warmth on his face. Why is that, friends and neighbors? Why is that, oh great wise ones?
You're no better than a monkey on a stick.
Monkey on a stick. Monkey. Monkey, Henry says. He's rubbing his temples with the tips of his fingers now. Monkey on a stick. Monkey on a stick. Who said that?
He plays the 911. Kiss my scrot, you monkey. He plays his memory. You're no better than a monkey on a stick.
Warmth on his face. Heat? Light? Both? Henry pops out the 911 tape and sticks in the one Jack brought today.
Hello, Judy. Are you Judy today or are you Sophie? The Abala sends his best, and Gorg says, caw, caw, caw. Husky, phlegmy laughter. Ty says hello, too. Your little boy is very lonely.
When Tyler Marshall's weeping, terrified voice booms through the speakers, Henry winces and fast forwards.
There will be more murders.
The accent much thicker now, a burlesque, a joke. Katzenjammer kids meet the Wolfman, but somehow even more revealing because of that.
They're little children, harvested like weed,
harvested like a monkey on a stick, Henry says. Monkey harvested.
Who are you, you son of a bitch? There are whips in hell and chains in Sheol.
But it's almost vips in hell, almost chens in Sheol.
Vips, chens, mungy on a stick, a stig.
You're no better in, Henry begins. And then, all at once, another line comes to him.
Lady McGowan's nightmare, that one's good.
A bad nightmare of what? Vips in hell? Chens in Sheol? Mungies on sticks? My God, Henry says softly. Oh, my God. The dance. He was at the dance. Now it all begins to fall into place. How stupid they have been. How criminally stupid. The boy's bike. It had been right there. Right there, for Christ's sake. They were all blind men. Make them all umps.
But he was so old, Henry whispers.
And senile. How are we supposed to guess such a man could be the fisherman? Other questions follow this one. If the fisherman is a resident at Maxton Elder Care, for instance, where in God's name could he have stashed Ty Marshall? And how is the bastard getting around French Landing? Does he have a car somewhere?
Doesn't matter, Henry murmurs. Not now, anyway. Who is he and where is he? Those are the things that matter.
The warmth on his face, his mind's first effort to locate the fisherman's voice in time and place, had been the spotlight, of course. Symphonic stand spotlight, the pink of ripening berries. And some woman, some nice old woman, Mr. Stan, you-hoo, Mr. Stan, had asked him if he took requests. Only before Stan could reply, a voice as flat and hard as two stones grinding together,
I was here first, old woman,
had interrupted. Flat and hard, and with that faint Germanic harshness that said Southside Chicago, probably second or even third generation. Not was here first, not old woman, but those telltale V's had been lurking, hadn't they?
Ah, yes. Monkey, Henry says, looking straight ahead,
looking straight at Charles Burnside, had he only known it. Stig, harvested, hasta la vista, baby. Was that what it came down to in the end? A dotty old maniac who sounded a bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger? Who was the woman? If he can remember her name, he can call Jack, or Dale if Jack's still not answering his phone, and put an end to French Landing's bad dream.
Lady McGowan's nightmare. That one's good.
Nightmare, Henry says. Then adjusting his voice,
nightmare.
Once again, the mimicry is good. Certainly too good for the old codger standing outside the studio door. He is now scowling bitterly and gnashing the hedge clippers in front of the glass. How can the blind man in there sound so much like him? It's not right. It's completely improper. The old monster longs to cut the vocal cords right out of Henry Layden's throat. Soon, he promises himself, he will do that and eat them. Sitting in the swivel chair, drumming his fingers nervously on the gleaming oak in front of him, Henry recalls the brief encounter at the bandstand. Not long into the Strawberry Fest dance, this had been. "Tell me your name and what you'd like to hear."
"I am Alice Weathers, and Moonglow, please, by Benny Goodman."
"Alice Weathers," Henry says. "That was her name. And if she doesn't know your name, my homicidal friend, then I'm a monkey on a stick." He starts to get up, and that is when someone, something, begins to knock, very softly, on the glass upper half of the door. Bear Girl has drawn close, almost against her will, and now she, Jack, Doc, and the bees are gathered around the sofa. Mouse has sunk halfway into it. He looks like a person dying badly in quicksand. Well, Jack thinks there's no quicksand, but he's dying badly, all right. Guess there's no question about that. "Listen up," Mouse tells them. The black goo is forming at the corners of his eyes again. Worse, it's trickling from the corners of his mouth. The stench of decay is stronger than ever as Mouse's inner workings give up the struggle. Jack is frankly amazed that they've lasted as long as they have. "You talk," Beezer says. "We'll listen." Mouse looks at Doc.
"When I finish, give me the fireworks, the Cadillac dope. Understand?
You want to get out ahead of whatever it is you've got." Mouse nods. "I'm down with that," Doc agrees. "You go out with a smile on your face."
"Doubt that, bro, but I'll give it a try."
Mouse shifts his reddening gaze to Beezer.
"When it's done, wrap me up in one of the nylon tents that are in the garage. Stick me in the tub. I'm betting that by midnight you'll be able to wash me down the drain like so much beer foam. I'd be careful, though. Don't touch what's left."
Bear Girl bursts into tears.
"Don't cry, darling," Mouse says. "I'm gonna get out ahead. Doc promised. Bees?
Right here, buddy.
You have a little service for me, okay? Read a poem. The one by Auden. The one that always used to frost your balls."
"Thou shalt not read the Bible for its prose," Beezer says. He's crying.
"You got it, Mousy. Play some Dead. Ripple, maybe. And make sure you're full enough at Kingsland to christen me good and proper into the next life. Guess there won't be any grave for you to piss on, but do the best you can."
Jack laughs at that. He can't help it. And this time it's his turn to catch the full force of Mouse's crimson eyes.
"Promise me you'll wait until tomorrow to go out there, cop."
"Mouse, I'm not sure I can do that."
"You gotta. Go out there tonight. You won't have to worry about the devil, dog. The other things in the woods around that house. The other things..."
The red eyes roll horribly. Black stuff trickles into Mouse's beard like tar. Then he somehow forces himself to go on.
"The other things in those woods will eat you like candy."
"I think that's a chance I'll have to take," Jack says, frowning. "There's a little boy somewhere."
"Safe,"
Mouse whispers. Jack raises his eyebrows, unsure if he's heard Mouse right. And even if he has, can he trust what he's heard? Mouse has some powerful, evil poison working in him. So far, he's been able to withstand it, to communicate in spite of it. But
safe for a little while, Mouse says. "Not from everything. There's things that might still get him, I suppose. But for the time being, he's safe from Mr. Munching. Is that his name? Munching?"
"Munshun, I think. How do you know it?" Mouse favors Jack with a smile of surpassing eeriness. It is the smile of a dying sibyl. Once more he manages to touch his forehead, and Jack notes with horror that the man's fingers are now melting into one another and turning black from the nails down.
"Got it up here, man. Got it all up here. Told you that. And listen, it's better the kid should get eaten by some giant bug or rock crab over there where he is than that you should die trying to rescue him. If you do that, the Abala will wind up with the kid for sure. That's what your friend says."
"What friend?" Doc asks suspiciously.
"Never mind," Mouse says. "Hollywood knows, don't you, Hollywood?"
Jack nods reluctantly. It's Speedy, of course, or Parkus if you prefer.
"Wait until tomorrow," Mouse says. "High noon, when the sun's strongest in both worlds. Promise."
At first, Jack can say nothing. He's torn in something close to agony.
"It'd be almost full dark before he could get back out Highway 35 anyway," Bear Girl says quietly.
"And there's bad shit in those woods, all right," Doc says. "Makes the stuff in that Blair Witch Project look fucking tame. I don't think you want to try it in the dark. Not unless you got a death wish, that is."
"When you're done," Mouse whispers, "when you're done, if any of you are left, burn the place to the ground. That hole, that tomb, burn it to the ground. You hear me? Close the door."
"Yeah," Beezer says. "Heard and understood, buddy."
"Last thing," Mouse says. He's speaking directly to Jack now. "You may be able to find it, but I think I got something else you need. It's a word. It's powerful to you because of something you touched once a long time ago. I don't understand that part,
but it's all right," Jack tells him. "I do. What's the word, Mouse?" For a moment, he doesn't think Mouse will, in the end, be able to tell him. Something is clearly struggling to keep him from saying the word. But in this struggle, Mouse comes out on top. It is, Jack thinks, very likely his life's last W.
"Diyamba," Mouse says. "Now you, Hollywood, you say it."
"Diyamba," Jack says. And a row of weighty paperbacks slides from one of the makeshift shelves at the foot of the couch. They hang there in the dimming air, hang, hang, and then drop to the floor with a crash. Bear Girl voices a little scream.
"Don't forget it," Mouse says. "You're gonna need it."
"How? How am I going to need it?" Mouse shakes his head wearily.
"Don't know."
Beezer reaches over Jack's shoulder and takes the pitiful little scribble of map. "You're going to meet us tomorrow morning at the sandbar," he tells Jack. "Get there by 11:30, and we should be turning into that goddamned lane right around noon. In the meantime, maybe I'll just hold on to this. A little insurance policy to make sure you do things Mouse's way."
"Okay," Jack says.
He doesn't need the map to find Chummy Burnside's black house. But Mouse is almost certainly right. It's probably not the sort of place you want to tackle after dark. He hates to leave Time Marshall in the Furnace Lands. It feels wrong in a way that's almost sinful. But he has to remember that there's more at stake here than one little boy lost.
"Beezer, are you sure you want to go back there?"
"Hell no, I don't want to go back," Beezer says, almost indignantly. "But something killed my daughter. My daughter! And it got here from there. You want to tell me you don't know that's true?"
Jack makes no reply. Of course it's true. And of course he wants Doc and the bees with him when he turns up the lane to Black House. If they can bear to come, that is. "Diyamba," he thinks. "Diyamba. Don't forget."
He turns back to the couch. "Mouse, do you know?" Doc says.
"Guess he won't need the Cadillac dope after all."
"Huh?" Jack peers at the big brewer biker stupidly. He feels stupid. Stupid and exhausted.
"Nothing ticking but his watch," Doc says. And then he begins to sing.
After a moment, Beezer joins in, then Bear Girl. Jack steps away from the couch with a thought queerly similar to Henry's. How did it get late so early? Just how in hell did that happen? In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here, and when we're gone from here. Jack tiptoes across the room. On the far side there's a lighted Kingsland Premium Golden Pale Ale bar clock. Our old friend, who is finally looking every year of his age, and not quite so lucky, peers at the time with disbelief, not accepting it until he has compared it to his own watch. Almost 8. He has been here for hours. Almost dark, and the fisherman still out there someplace, not to mention his otherworldly playmates. The Yamba, he thinks again as he opens the door. And as he steps out onto the splintery porch and closes the door behind him, he speaks aloud with great sincerity into the darkening day. Speedy, I'd like to wring your neck. Chapter 24. The Yamba is a bright and powerful spell. Powerful connections form a web that extends, ramifying throughout infinity. When Jack Sawyer peels the living poison from Mouse's eyes, Diamba first shines within the dying man's mind. And that mind momentarily expands into knowledge. Down the filaments of the web flows some measure of its shining strength, and soon a touch of Diamba reaches Henry Layden. Along the way, the Diamba brushes Tansy Furneaux, who, seated in a windowed alcove of the sandbar, observes a wry, beautiful young woman take smiling shape in the pool of light at the far end of the parking lot, and realizes a moment before the young woman vanishes that she has been given a glimpse of the person her Irma would have become. And it touches Dale Gilbertson, who, while driving home from the station, experiences a profound, sudden yearning for the presence of Jack Sawyer, a yearning like an ache in his heart, and vows to pursue the fisherman case to the end with him, no matter what the obstacles. The Diamba quivers, flashing down a filament to Judy Marshall, and opens a window into Faraway, where Ty sleeps in an iron-colored cell, awaiting rescue and still alive. Within Charles Burnside, it touches the true fisherman, Mr. Munshun, once known as the Monday Man, just as Bernie's knuckles wrap the glass. Mr. Munshun feels a subtle drift of cold air infiltrate his chest like a warning, and freezes with rage and hatred at this violation. Charles Burnside, who knows nothing of Diamba and cannot hate it, picks up his master's emotion and remembers the time when a boy supposed dead in Chicago crept out of a canvas sack and soaked the back seat of his car in incriminating blood. Damnably incriminating blood, a substance that continued to mock him long after he had washed away its visible traces. But Henry Layden, with whom we began this chain, is visited not by grace or rage. What touches Henry is a kind of informed clarity. Rhoda's visits, he realizes, were one and all produced by his loneliness. The only thing he heard climbing the steps was his unending need for his wife. And the being on the other side of his studio door is the horrible old man from Maxton's, who intends to do to Henry the same thing he has done to 3 children. Who else would appear at this hour and knock on the studio window? Not Dale, not Jack, and certainly not Elvina Morton. Everyone else would stay outside and ring the doorbell. It takes Henry no more than a couple of seconds to consider his options and work out a rudimentary plan. He supposes himself both quicker and stronger than the fisherman, who sounded like a man in his mid to late 80s, and the fisherman does not know that his would-be victim is aware of his identity. To take advantage of this situation, Henry has to appear puzzled but amiable, as if he is merely curious about his visitor. And once he opens the studio door, which unfortunately he has left unlocked, he will have to act with speed and decisiveness. Are we up to this? Henry asks himself, and thinks, we'd better be. Are the lights on? No. Because he expected to be alone, he never bothered with the charade of switching them on. The question then becomes, how dark is it outside? Maybe not quite dark enough, Henry imagines. An hour later, he would be able to move through the house entirely unseen and escape through the back door. Now his odds are probably no better than 50-50. But the sun is sinking at the back of his house, and every second he can delay buys him another fraction of darkness in the living room and kitchen. Perhaps 2 seconds have passed since the lurking figure rapped on the window, and Henry, who has maintained the perfect composure of one who failed to hear the sound made by his visitor, can stall no longer. Pretending to be lost in thought, with one hand he grips the base of a heavy Excellence in Broadcasting Award, accepted in absentia by George Rathbun some years before, and with the other scoops from a shallow tray before him a switchblade an admirer once left at the university radio station as a tribute to the Wisconsin Rat. Henry uses the knife to unwrap CD jewel boxes, and not long ago, in search of something to do with his hands, he taught himself how to sharpen it. With its blade retracted, the knife resembles an odd, flat fountain pen. Two weapons are twice as good as one, he thinks, especially if your adversary imagines the second weapon to be harmless. Now it has been 4 seconds since the rapping came from the window by his side, and in their individual ways, both Bernie and Mr. Munshun have grown considerably more restive. Mr. Munshun recoils in loathing from the suggestion of D'Yamba that has somehow contaminated this otherwise delightful scene. Its appearance can mean one thing only, that some person connected to the blind man managed to get close enough to Black House to have tasted the poisons of its ferocious guardian. And that, in turn, means that now the hateful Jack Sawyer undoubtedly knows of the existence of Black House and intends to breach its defenses. It is time to destroy the blind man and return home. Bernie registers only an inchoate mixture of hatred and an emotion surprisingly like fear from within his master. Bernie feels rage at Henry Layden's appropriation of his voice, for he knows it represents a threat. Even more than this self-protective impulse, he feels a yearning for the simple but profound pleasure of bloodletting. When Henry has been butchered, Charles Burnside wishes to claim one more victim before flying to Black House and entering a realm he thinks of as Sheol. His big, misshapen knuckles rap once more against the glass. Henry turns his head to the window in a flawless imitation of mild surprise. I thought someone was out there. Who is it? Come on, speak up. He toggles a switch and speaks into the mic. If you're saying anything, I can't hear you. Give me a second or two to get organized in here and I'll be right out. He faces forward again and hunches over his desk. His left hand seems idly to touch his handsome award. His right hand is hidden from sight. Henry appears to be deep in concentration. In reality, he is listening as hard as he ever has in his life. He hears the handle on the studio door revolve clockwise with a marvelous slowness. The door whispers open an inch, 2 inches, 3. The floral, musky scent of my sin invades the studio, seeming to coat a thin chemical film over the mic, the tape canisters, all the dials, and the back of Henry's deliberately exposed neck. The sole of what sounds like a carpet slipper hushes over the floor. Henry tightens his hands on his weapons and waits for the particular sound that will be his signal. He hears another nearly soundless step, then another, and knows the fisherman has moved behind him. He carries some weapon of his own, something that cuts through the mist of perfume with the grassy smell of front yards and the smoothness of machine oil. Henry cannot imagine what this is, but the movement of the air tells him it is heavier than a knife. Even a blind man can see that. An awkwardness in the way the fisherman takes his next oh-so-quiet step suggests to Henry that the old fellow holds this weapon with both of his hands. An image is formed in Henry's mind, that of his adversary standing behind him poised to strike, and to this image he now adds extended, upraised arms. The hands hold an instrument like garden shears. Henry has his own weapons, the best of these being surprise, but the surprise must be well-timed to be effective. In fact, if Henry is to avoid a quick and messy death, his timing has to be perfect. He lowers his neck farther over the desk and awaits the signal. His calm surprises him. A man standing unobserved with an object like garden shears or a heavy pair of scissors in his hands behind a seated victim will, before delivering the blow, take a long second to arch his back and reach up to get a maximum of strength into the downward stroke. As he extends his arms and arches his back, his clothing will shift on his body. Fabric will slide over flesh. One fabric may pull against another. A belt may creak. There will be an intake of breath. An ordinary person would hear few or none of these telltale disturbances, but Henry Layden can be depended upon to hear them all. Then at last, he does. Cloth rubs against skin and rustles against itself. Air hisses into Bernie's nasal passages. Instantly, Henry shoves his chair backward and in the same movement spins around and swings the award toward his assailant as he stands upright. It works. He feels the force of the blow run down his arm and hears a grunt of shock and pain. The odor of my sin fills his nostrils. The chair bumps the top of his knees. Henry pushes the button on the switchblade, feels the long blade leap out, and thrusts it forward. The knife punches into flesh. From 8 inches before his face comes a scream of outrage. Again, Henry batters the award against his attacker, then yanks the knife free and shoves it home again. Skinny arms tangle around his neck and shoulders, filling him with revulsion, and foul breath washes into his face. He becomes aware that he has been injured, for a pain that is sharp on the surface and dull beneath announces itself on the left side of his back. The goddamn hedge clippers, he thinks, and jabs again with the knife. This time he stabs only empty air.